So now that it's being recorded, I guess you guys know that. Feel free to use a pseudonym or just your first name, whatever you prefer. Also, it's always important to note that this is basically a book group. You know, people who often have recovered from advice.
Forrest, I'm sorry to tell you this, but you're really cutting in and out for me, so I don't know if this is coming across what you're saying.
Ditto, oh. The same thing at my end, too.
Okay. So I am out in New Hampshire, and it could be that I don't have the best connection. But we'll stick with it. Did anyone have any questions about kind of the recording thing or the we aren't doctors and therapists? Did that come across? Someone want to repeat it if it didn't?
Well, can I understand correctly what you're saying, Forrest, is that everybody here is not professionals and we're not giving advice, we're just sharing our experience. Is that basically the gist of it?
Exactly. Yep.
Great.
So it sounds like my audio connect isn't great. Enjoy. Would you like to greet everyone, Gus, what we're covering today, and then hand it off to Bruce?
Okay, sure. Yeah, we're still studying pathways to pain relief by two psychiatrists. The first gentleman, I've forgotten his name, but the other lady is Dr. Summers. I've just been looking at her photo on one of her books, and she looks like a very wise, wise lady. So, yeah, it's exciting to be able to study her work. And the section that we're studying now is called Speaking Out for Yourself, which I think is something that almost everybody can relate to. It's sort of something I think probably most people suffer from to some extent, and we just have to get over it. So that's what we're going to do today. So my name is Enjoy, and I understand that there are some other folks here that we've known from before. Of course, there's our pal Forrest. There's Bruce, who often does a really wonderful opening for the sessions, where he talks about what we've learned in the book and kind of reminds us. I'm not sure who, oh, Becca. Becca, of course, is there. What would we do without Becca? But I'm not sure who else is there, so maybe somebody can help me with that.
My name's Joy. I'm from New York.
Hi, Joy. I've talked to you before.
Yes.
Lovely to hear from you. Great. And is anyone else there that would like to? Oh, Leslie, of course. Leslie just came on. That's great. Who else?
Hello, my name's Mel. I'm also here.
Hi, Mel. How are you? Yeah, we've talked before,
good.
Too. Well, this is great fun. I'm really happy to be here this morning, and we're going to have a great session, so thank you.
Bruce, do you want to take it away?
Okay. Our topic today...
Thanks for that wonderful introduction.
Enjoy. Our topic today... addresses the case of a Mr. A, and the title is Speaking Up for Myself. And this is the last case study in the sections of Pathways to Pain Relief that cover patients that Dr. Sarno referred to, Frances Sumner Anderson, herself, Frances Anderson and Eric Sherman were Dr. Sarno's two principal psychotherapists. These were the ones Dr. Sarno sent patients to who didn't respond to his knowledge lectures and group meetings. And Mr. A, on the surface, appears quite conventional, but obviously has... boiling, repressed rage in his psyche that's manifesting as a shoulder problem, as pain in his shoulder. And at his first meeting with Dr. Anderson, he mentions almost in the same breath telling about his marriage of 17 years and his daughter, that he said, Mr. A said, "I can't articulate when I'm angry." And he also has a very revealing Freudian slip at this first meeting. He says, "I feel like I have to shoulder too much of the responsibility around the house." And he feels, I think Dr. Anderson says that Mr. A's wife has become a surrogate parent to him. Well, Mr. A comes from a large Irish Catholic family that with nine siblings, and he was caught between two brothers who he regarded as very successful athletically and professionally, and he always had a negative view of himself. And also it becomes obvious throughout the case, as the case unfolds through, I think, five psychotherapy sessions, that his older brother, now deceased, had picked on him, had once thrown him down a flight of stairs, in fact. And at the end of the first session, Mr. A expressed to Dr. Anderson that he was surprised by the fact that he had talked so much about his stress at home with his wife and only child, a dearly beloved daughter, age 16. His daughter is challenging him in various ways that Dr. Anderson notes are perfectly appropriate for a 16-year-old. When she dyed her hair red or purple or so on, whatever it was, Mr. A had reacted negatively to this. And he also felt he was losing her, losing his daughter, as she tried to establish her own identity apart from his. And he felt out like he couldn't communicate with his wife. He felt like they weren't on the same page about how to deal with their daughter. And as Dr. Anderson says, who sounded like she was behaving in expectable, challenging ways for a 16-year-old. And he talks a bit about his early relationship with his wife, how they lived together for 3 years before they got married and had a great time. But when she became pregnant, he felt that marrying her was the right thing to do, and he did a month and a half later. It seems like he does everything that way. He always does the right thing. And he's gone through a series of what he calls amassed losses. The death of his mother to cancer, the death of his older brother, who, incidentally, it turns out, had a back problem of his own, the death of his father. He says, "I was the third child. I was wedged between two athletic brothers, two successful males. He doesn't feel that he's doing as well as he would like to professionally, even though his income is good. He's got this constant self-depreciation going on. Even when he is successful and things are going good, he doesn't feel like that." And he has a conflict with a coworker named Joe at work, who's brash and loud and insists on them going out to lunch together, which he obviously doesn't like. Again, it's an example of not speaking up for himself. And again, he was surprised at the end of the second session just how much he talked to Dr. Anderson about the time he spent talking about domestic conflicts. Obviously, this stuff has never been, he doesn't articulate it. He refers to his wife at this second session. She dismissed my opinion. She didn't listen to me. I'm angry at her and disappointed. I'm angry at myself for participating the way I did. I don't stand up for myself. He goes on to say that he had never resolved this kind of conflict. He was what you call the nice guy, I'd say, and had learned that pattern. He also learned it from his mother, too, who he regarded as a martyr to the family as she died of cancer. It became a paradigm for him. Her example was a paradigm of martyrdom and suffering that he adopted. Let's see. Finally, at the end of the sessions, I guess about at the time of his 50th birthday on September 11th, 2001, I'm surprised that Dr. Anderson didn't note the date. Isn't that 9/11? Mm-hmm. And he describes his improvement under therapy, Mr. A does. He says, I'm speaking up more with Joe. My shoulder is much better. I had a dream last night. I was in The Sopranos. I felt trapped like the people in The Sopranos. I feel stuck in areas of my life. I did it to myself. I created my situation. I didn't speak up for myself again in the interest of getting security. Security within that family hierarchy, no doubt. Anderson asks him, how would you want to feel instead of trapped? And Mr. A responds, I'd be free, go out to lunch, live further out in the country, but I have to get my daughter educated. So the responsibility still continues, but he'd make a little more space for himself too, which he obviously hasn't been doing for years and years, the 17 years of their marriage. He doesn't even mention that he might have felt trapped getting married to his wife because she got pregnant. I just did the right thing. That was the right thing. He always did the right thing. And he never spoke up. And it manifested as his sore shoulder. It's interesting, too, that the illnesses that he had when he changed high school, at the time that his older brother threw him down a flight of stairs. He had two awful years in high school there. He said, I got physical symptoms and developed a self-depreciating sense of humor, making fun of himself. We've all seen that in high school. In the dream, it's like the dog was sweating tears. I was always trying to take it. And there's that very revealing dream that he had on St. Patrick's Day. He says, I'm with a friend from high school, R. He's with me at my parents' house, showing me how to cook chicken. My older brother is hobbling on crutches. Again, the back comes up. My father is not feeling well. I look at the fireplace, and R is cooking our dog. She has a regal, noble bearing. Parts of her body are cooking. I was eating this meat. Of course, he woke up in the morning with an upset stomach. Mm-hmm. And he associates this dream, Mr. A does, with his daughters asking for a pet gerbil, a kind of a mouse. And it's incidentally cannibalistic, too. It eats its own kind. And then he describes about their dog, C. And then he goes on to his last 2 years in high school and all the suffering he went through with his brother. And then the physical symptoms. But once he went away to college, all of these symptoms disappeared as he established his own self-identity. And now they're coming back to haunt him, obviously, this original family dynamic. So there's just so much in this story I'm sure Forrest is has many more points to cover than I can in this brief synopsis.
Well, I thought you did a tremendous job, Bruce. So thank you very much for that. I really enjoyed listening to your thoughts. And I don't actually know if I have that much more to add. I know that my microphone isn't working very well, so I think it might be good if other people want to jump in, perhaps enjoy as a host and facilitator to kind of push the story forward. But it was interesting to see how many people could relate to this story and relate to the need to stand up for yourself. I'm glad to hear Lenore say in the chat room that my audio is working better, so that's a big reassurance. But he just seems like such the prototypical TMS goodist, slaving away, trying to work very hard to raise money for a family. And he must be feeling so unappreciated by his wife. And, you know, maybe it's developmentally appropriate for her, for his daughter to be rebelling and unappreciative, but I'm sure it makes him angry as well, all of that.
Well, what this Forrest, is that it reminded me of somebody in my own family who tends to be like that. Again, sort of a similar situation, because he was kind of bossed around by other siblings, and he just grew up to be a person who doesn't even recognize his own anger. I gather that the gentleman in this case study does realize that he's angry, and but you know, there's different degrees of repression going on here. And what I wanted to say from the point of view of the of the wife and other people in the family is that it's really difficult when you have someone excuse me who can't stand up for themselves, won't stand up for themselves, won't even usually admit that they're angry, because that would start a conversation to where they don't want to go. And it's really hard not to be bossy and not take over. And not as difficult for me as it is for somebody, some other people maybe, but I know I try really hard and just say, you know, balls in his court, but very difficult. Sooner or later I say, oh, for Pete's sake, you know. and I proceed to behave the way he's perceiving his wife to behave. So, you know, she could be a perfectly nice lady if he could stand up for himself. But, I mean, this is very interesting, because at least he realizes he has that problem, and he has a wonderful psychiatrist to help him get over it. It's how the rest of us deal with it that's interesting, too.
But remember, he's hiding his expenses from his wife, possibly for this psychotherapy, too. He's embarrassed about spending any money on his things.
That self-assertion is tough for him. Why do you think he holds back? I mean, it was really interesting hearing Enjoy talk about, you know, like, just waiting. The ball's in his court, and then you just kind of lose it. I think when the ball was in his court, he didn't step forward and take a swing. And, you know, what's holding him back?
I think that oftentimes, you know, I mean, it's like everything. You get something out of it, right? And I don't know if that's discussed in here. I didn't notice it when I was reading it myself. But we all get something out of whatever behavior we're doing. So maybe he's just avoiding conflict. Maybe it makes him feel superior because other people are being invasive and he's being, you know, patient and tolerant, or, you know, no, who knows how he thinks about this, but it's really an interesting topic, because so many of us have these issues at times in our lives.
I think his position in the family hierarchy between the older and the younger brother, and the invidious comparisons that the negative comparisons that he made to their athleticism and success echoed throughout his life. His behavior patterns were determined there, while we don't want to say determined, but they were certainly they certainly hardened during that period. And then possibly with his identification with his mother, his long-suffering mother and her martyrdom to cancer, it's obvious that he took after mom rather than the abusive older brother. And yet he had a gout attack on the very anniversary, wasn't it? On the eve of the anniversary of his brother's death. There's this big symbolic anniversary thing. I forget where that is. That March 14th, that St. Patrick's Day, that links all of them in death and mortality. And I've noticed, I know a lot of people who are getting or having children who are 16 and 17 and in their early 20s, who are now making them feel older. They're challenged by the fact that their children are growing up and that they're aging. There's nothing that causes you to feel so mortal as to see that your children are getting stronger physically than you are, and also challenging you. Remember, Mr. A was a Vietnam era rebel, and he couldn't see how his daughter was doing the same thing in a diminished mode, perhaps. The shoe was on the other foot, I guess. Lots of parents have trouble when the kids start to get into puberty and start to become young adults, because that calls their whole identity into question.
It's a shift, and that seems to be, I mean, maybe one of the reasons why he didn't step forward and assert himself is just that it was a comfortable pattern. And so, I mean, maybe change scares us a lot. Why did you not? I mean, maybe some of the people on the call right now, why is it challenging for all of us to assert ourselves?
Yeah, the era of transition is always challenging, as Thomas Carlyle pointed out in his History of the French Revolution. We're always living in an era of transition. That's the nature of the modern world, I think. But it gets back to what Dr. Zaffirides has to say about these existential crisis points. And that's one of them. Kids beginning to get to be adults, and that's what's heating this up, I think, in Mr. A's consciousness.
That's really interesting, because last Saturday, when I wasn't here, I was at the masterclass pilot program in New York, and Dr. Rashbaum was presenting the physician's perspective. Dr. Rashbaum is he's the person who's practicing who has, who's worked, the doctor who's worked the most with Dr. Sarno by a long shot, and he's the person who's practicing who's working the longest time in the TMS approach. Anyway, he talked about the difference between disparate and youth. Now, from our reading, we may be familiar with the concept of by Bellier and Cannon. And don't want to get too academic here, but the stress response can happen in response to good things or in response to bad things. But the same root as euphoria. By the way, you're becoming unmuted. And then the reverse of that.
Sorry, I hate to interrupt, but I cannot hear almost half the words you're saying because you're breaking up really bad. That's why I keep unmuting myself and trying to interject.
Oh, thank you. Are other people having that problem?
I'm getting the same problem.
Oh, what a shame. What a shame. Okay.
Have you checked your Bantam jack?
I'll play with it later. I think the USB connection is good. The headphone connection is good. But I just wanted to say that in the Holmes and Rahe stress scale, sometimes good things that signify transitions can also cause a stress. So perhaps the reason that we don't assert ourselves and don't break these old patterns is that cause a stress. So it's a reaction.
There, you're fading.
Okay. Well, I'll try to call another call.
I can't.
Enjoy, Rebecca. Do you want to take on facilitation? I'll try and call back.
Enjoy. Do you think you're comfortable doing that? Because I think you got a good handle on the book.
I'm sorry, I missed what? Doing what?
Oh, facilitation.
Oh well, I'll try. But yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. Why not?
You're gonna do great.
Oh yeah. I don't think so, but there you go. It's we all said we were amateurs, didn't we? So
yeah,
get a display. Yeah, no, that's very interesting, Bruce. I really enjoyed you going over it like that. I've read the thing actually a couple of times because I'm getting older and I don't remember things the way I did when I was really young, but. What she said. So, can I ask if anybody wondered about him? Well, he said over and over and over again, "I don't stand up for myself. I don't stand up for myself." And he's okay. Does anybody know why there's a beep happening in my ear? Hello.
I don't hear it. No idea.
Okay, good. As long as it's because it was pretty invasive. Okay, I'm just wondering, did anybody else notice that he just constantly said, "I don't stand up for myself"? He seemed to have a really good handle on what the problem was. He just was not able to get past why he was doing that and what to do about it. And I'd love to hear if someone has any comments about that. If you haven't read the book yourself, you could talk about something that's happened to you where you know what the problem is, but you have trouble getting past it. Anybody?
Someone?
I think
I think that's the problem of TMS itself, isn't it? You know that there's a problem there when you feel the pain, but getting past it, past the emotional barriers, and actually solving the problem.
That's a really good point. That's why we're here, isn't it?
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Well, it's the human condition, but even more so maybe in TMS.
Yeah, he does emphasize again and again. He puts his finger right on the problem. And, Dr. Sarno in the introduction to Pathways says that you don't need to solve the problem as much as you need to know about it. And I think in this case, Mr. A's talk therapy with Dr. Anderson is reducing his shoulder pain simply because he's actually expressing these things. Remember how he says he's surprised that he's talking about family turmoil, which he didn't think he had. This perfect marriage of 17 years with the lovely daughter that they adore. He didn't see the kind of repression involved. Just speaking up to Dr. Anderson and articulating this is part of his cure. He obviously still has a long way to go, but remember, he stands up to Joe, although Joe feels hurt about it. His coworker, the loud, brash one who insists on them going out to lunch all the time, much to Mr. A's chagrin. He does start taking some positive steps. And he starts up doing something for himself. He returns to music. And I guess playing or composing music, something he'd never done before.
I thought, I'm trying to call in on the phone. Is this a little bit better?
Oh, that's
well,
great.
I can hear you.
Perfect.
Wonderful. Okay, good. I couldn't because I was, trying to get a better connection. But, yeah, when I have unwanted emotions, I think of it as a multi-step process. And Bruce was just talking about how the first step for him was talking about it with Dr. Anderson. Oh, by the way, before I forget, I just want to say it's Dr. Francis Summer Anderson. Dr. Anderson is how I abbreviate is her middle name, and she's a psychologist. Is the class of license that he has. The type of it's called psychoanalyst.
Okay, that's not really working. Forrest, you're breaking up again, and you're on the phone. Oh, dear. It's not your end at all, perhaps.
It probably is. She's a psychiatrist who prescribes medicine. Can you hear me now?
No, it's not good. Sorry. What I was trying to do when I was asking before was I was thinking that we, as Forrest is trying to do right now, I think we can all relate to that to some extent. And I was hoping that there might be people who had some personal comments about it. I don't want to pick on anybody in particular, so it would be great if you have anything to add. Times when it's been hard for you to stand up for yourself and what you did about it, whether the occasion just came and went or whether you were able to somehow gather the resources or what happened. That's what I'm hoping somebody might have an anecdote to share.
I can think of times that an office bully has picked on me and I bent over and over and over again trying to be the nice guy. Instead of standing up to him. There are a lot of people who get by with just bullying, and they rely on nice guys who take it. Part of the whole dynamic at work is taking it from the boss, too, and shutting up because you want to get your reward. The little world and the big world. It's one of the classic dynamics in society at large.
I think you've made a really interesting point here, Bruce. I hope I'm not interrupting, but really, Mr. A is the kind of person who does get bullied. Isn't he? Wherever you go. I mean, we've all seen it in school and at work. And that's very interesting because I think that's a hot topic right now. We have to do something about bullies in this world. So this is a great topic. Has anybody been thinking about, like, do you have a story to share with us? Sorry to be pushy about that. I hope I'm not. But I guess what it is that when people start to talk about themselves and what's happened to them, this is the most interesting part of the discussion. So that's why I'm trying to encourage it.
I think so too. And I'm going to take try number three. I'm on a different phone.
Better.
Telling my own story. So what do I do when I have emotions like that? I sometimes I'm really hard on myself, and it's an emotion that doesn't want to go away. So for Mr. A, it's one becomes aware of it. For Mr. A, it's more behavioral. It's like a phobia, like he's having difficulty standing up for himself. Whereas for me, it's just kind of feeling wise and emotion. But in the same, I think that the way of overcoming it is similar. I think it usually starts with insight. That's always the first step, and being able to articulate it seems to be helping for Mr. A. For a lot of people, I think there's this concept of mindfulness. First, you have to know what you feel. You have to know why you feel it. Mr. A probably is getting some benefit by going back to the past. I know that I've gotten a lot of benefit by going back to the past. In the training that I worked on last Saturday, I think that was helpful for me to have to think about this, to make a kind of a systematic picture of how my personality got to be the way that it is. And then, as it happens, I think it's good to be mindful. So for anyone who is struggling to stand up for themselves, I think I was hearing earlier about how, you know, he wants to keep his job. He does want to provide. And I think that's maybe he emphasizes that too much and sacrifices too much to be this hard, toiling breadwinner. But there's some truth in that. You still have to have a job. And Dr. Sherman occasionally mentions, you know, like, you're going to have rage at your boss, but it doesn't mean you can tell him or her off immediately or at all. And so I think the first step, I guess, when you're learning to assert yourself is just to become aware of your emotion. Perhaps for me, it's helpful to feel the emotion in the body, to kind of let it cool down, and then just to think, okay, what are my options here? Because, you know, there's a reason why we don't assert ourselves, and I think learning to assert oneself is a skill, and it's one that you don't necessarily want to rush. You just want to start becoming more aware of it and more aware of what your options are, and then perhaps talk about it, like what you could have done in a given situation and how it would make you feel and why you might feel that way along the way. That's my take on it.
One thing I noticed that Mr. A has never done or never has not come to doing is identifying his older brother as a bully. He still feels subordinate to him and unsuccessful in relation to his brother. You notice that in high school, when his older brother threw Mr. A down a flight of stairs, yet his brother always included him with his friends. I was 14 and he was 17. So the daughter is right in the middle of that age group, age range, when he became trapped in this relationship of taking it. You know, brother throws you down a flight of stairs. You really took it.
Yeah. So he had a lot to lose if he stood up to his brother there, right? Like, if he stood up to his brother, maybe his brother would get pissed and he'd lose his social contact with the older, cool kids. So he really wanted to do it, and maybe that's where that pattern got established.
Well, that's one of the patterns that bullies rely on, too, is they include the one they pick on in the group. And that becomes their role.
Yeah. Yeah, so part of the reason why you have a place in the group is because you're accepting that kind of abuse. That's interesting.
And it's comfortable. Like that seems like, when I try and think, why didn't he step forward when the ball was in his court? Maybe that's kind of the childhood roots of it, is I might be getting picked on, but at least I know I'm safe like this. At least I know that, you know, they're going to pick on me, but I still have friends.
Wow.
Even if they pick on me.
Yeah. Wow. Well, and in a family relationship too, you know, you can do that. I mean, if you've got a good thing going, just because somebody has a bad day, you're just going to let it go. You're going to let it go. So maybe letting yourself being bullied is just carrying that natural reaction to an extreme.
Right.
I think what you said for us seems to be confirmed by Mr. A himself in his last therapy session with Dr. Anderson. He says, I didn't speak up for myself in the interest of getting security somehow in this social pecking order that had been established in the home. He maintained his position between the two brothers by never speaking up for himself and taking it.
Wow.
It's almost like that.
Based on the example of his mother, which isn't explained too much here.
It's almost like, I'm really glad that you mentioned that example of being thrown down the stairs by the brother and still being able to hang out, because it feels like there's kind of a similar thing going on in his family right now. Like it just sounds like his relationship with his wife isn't very good, and I feel really bad for him because of that relationship with his wife. But at the same time, you know, if he did speak up to his brother, then he might lose the friendship with the brother. And if he speaks up with the wife, well, it's true that if he starts asserting himself more, that relationship could falter, could lead to divorce. Maybe.
Well, it's thrown in there as a little tidbit that they basically stopped having relations after the daughter was born.
Right.
And
yeah.
So all of this affection that he would have for his wife, Mr. A has transferred onto his daughter. So when his daughter begins to assert her independence, this is a crushing blow for him.
But Bruce, I don't have the text in front of me, but wasn't it him who pretty much stopped after his daughter was born? So maybe...
Let me see. I can find the...
Yeah, might be an idea. I got that impression.
Let's see... Oh, here it is. It's on the second page. That would be L2545 in the Kindle. Let's see. He said he would like to be closer to her, and then he guessed that his wife might feel that he doesn't care for her because their physical intimacy had decreased drastically shortly after their daughter was born. That's a defense there, that kind of rhetoric. He never explains whether it was her choice or his choice.
Yeah, but the implication, or at least what I'm inferring there, is that it was his choice, because he was saying his wife would have some cause to believe that he didn't have the affection that he had had before for her. So, that's interesting.
Yeah, because their physical intimacy had decreased drastically. Well, this is like, it happened. It isn't like either of them made a choice. You can only read into it. I think it was her.
I don't know. I mean, the fact that she was hurt, I think Joy makes a compelling argument there. But I have to say, this is exactly the type of detective work that I think is intended for this chapter. I think somewhere in this part of the book, Dr. Anderson writes that, you know, she provides detailed analyses about Ellen and Mrs. R, but for the final several stories, she just kind of lays out the facts, and it looks like she's giving you the raw notes excerpts from the raw notes from her sessions about some of the observation, and then kind of leaving it to us to kind of put it all together to figure out what's going on.
This is what I like so much about this group dynamic that we've got going here, because we can actually have those conversations.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I didn't have this when I went through it on my own. I mean, I did think, oh, I wonder how exactly that stopping of sexual activity occurred, you know, I thought it so quickly that I didn't answer myself. So it's great to be able to talk it over. That's what I like so much about this group. It's great.
Yeah, me too. And I'm really kind of thrilled about this observation about the parallel. I guess it's kind of got me, just the idea that, you know, there's loss involved. You lose the old thing. If you stand up and ask for a change, you lose the old thing that gives you great security, and it And that is perhaps, okay, so I can finish what I was saying before. Dr. Rashbaum talked about eustress versus distress. Eustress is stress that happens to us where we can become ill, according to Holmes and Rahe, because of something good. We get a promotion, and statistically we're more likely to get sick. Well, that was good news, but good news means transition. It means loss of the old, something new created, and that's eustress. Distress is when bad things happen. It seems like he's just scared about, I guess it isn't so much eustress there, if he does stand up for himself, but there is loss of the old. If he stands up to his brother, if he stands up to his wife and allows to lose the family unit that he has.
Yeah, then the whole pecking order is called into question if he does so. And he's been secure in this, in his martyrdom.
Yeah.
For a long, long time. Yeah,
anyone,
17 years. I married her because it was the right thing to do, not because I wanted to. And that gets back to his goodism, which, of course, Dr. Anderson underscores.
So I do want to say, I teach, and what I've noticed in teaching is that there are some people who love raising their hand and answering questions and chatting up a storm. That's wonderful. There are other people who don't, and that's totally fine, too. So if you guys, there are a bunch of people on the line now, and if you guys just want to listen in, that's great. You know, you can type something in the chat room. But can anyone else relate to this? You know, even if you haven't read the story, even if you just got Bruce's excellent summary at the beginning, anything that you think that we're missing here? Anything that kind of your experience, any questions that anyone wants to bring up? Yeah, I'll take that as a no. There was some instruction thing where they say, wait for 5 seconds, count it out. Yeah.
Hard to wait, though, Abe. Really hard.
Indeed. Well, it is actually perhaps appropriate because we are coming to the end of the time. And I think that for next, you know, people who are listening on the podcast right now, we're done discussing this story. We're going to get kind of into administrative stuff. I think, you know, this has been a fascinating book, and I think it's valuable for us not just to look at the individual stories, but to try to pull it all together and say, what did we learn from this experience of going over these case histories? You know, what are the major themes? You know, these, as we said several times, these are several of the psychotherapists who or psychologists who work most closely with Dr. Sarno. And what does this teach us about what one learns when one has the opportunity to go to one of these psychoanalysts? Obviously, going through psychoanalysis is, unfortunately, while it's a wonderful opportunity, it's very expensive. And one of the things I'm really excited about from this book is that it allows people who don't have that opportunity, such as myself and most of the people on the line, to learn about this approach and what Dr. Anderson and Dr. Sherman have learned from listening to their patients, because I think they're both very sensitive people. And they learn a lot by listening to their patients in the long-term form
I
therapy. So perhaps in the last session, we can talk about what we've learned from them, from what they've learned from their patients. Yeah, Bruce?
I think when you read Dr. Sarno for the first time, you always wonder how great a degree of symptoms, unresolved symptoms, are required for you to go into psychotherapy, or what does Dr. Sarno think? What kind of patients does Dr. Sarno refer to psychotherapy? You always wonder, well, are my problems so bad, or is my TMS pain so bad? Is there some kind of underlying psychodynamic problem that would require psychotherapy? this book lets you know how, what degree of severity of symptoms are necessary before you need to address them in a psychoanalytic context. And you can learn a lot more about TMS from studying this book, too. It's like a chronicle of different cases of repressed rage that confirm Dr. Sarno's diagnosis that the underlying problem is repressed rage, especially in our own culture. And you can see it like a theme moving through all of these case studies.
Yeah. Yeah, it's we repress our rage so deeply that it's hard to even, it was hard for me. Other people see it, and they say they see each other themselves on the page of every book, but it was hard for me to understand how I could be an angry person. And I think looking at some of these stories and the frustration of Mr. A, I think helps me understand how, you know, I'm a kind of a quiet guy, a technical guy, how I could have unconscious rage as well. And I think that's a kind of a healing and a healing thing and something that I'm grateful for.
Very interesting for us too, Forrest, that you're sharing that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, really. I'm getting so much out of it, and Bruce too. The way you guys have stepped up to the plate has been an inspiration.
Well, thank you. And you too, I have to say. I thought you did a great job of opening it up. So if I can just do, since we're getting, one of my jobs is to watch the clock, and we have 3 minutes before we are intruding upon the next event. I just wanted to give people a couple of announcements. Announcement number one is that Dr. Anderson mentioned that the paperback version of the book is coming out soon, paperback version of Pathways. So that is nice. I know we have it on Kindle, but that is, since it was in a public forum, I think I can repeat that. The next thing is, so, and I think more people will read the book, which I think is tremendous, because obviously you can learn a lot from it. Another really exciting announcement is Alan Gordon and I are working hard on creating his recovery program. He's been working on this for a year. Believe it or not. And when we did our third webinar with him, it was explicitly with the intention of filling in some gaps from the previous webinars so that he would have good audio where people could not just read about something, but they could see how it would play out with a real person and with all of the powerful cues that listening to someone can provide. So I'm very excited about the recovery program. We've got the final text, and integrating that with all of the audio and getting high-quality audio is going to take a while, but we're going to work on it hard, and it should be up by Tuesday, possibly even Monday, so very excited about that. And for listeners, the four co-hosts, Enjoy, Bruce, Eric, and myself, possibly Joy might join us. We haven't asked her. But anyway, the four existing co-hosts, we've talked about it, and we're planning on switching it from Saturdays to Tuesday evenings at 9 o'clock, 9 o'clock Eastern time, 6 o'clock Pacific time, so that we don't have to worry quite as much about banging into the drop-in chat thing, and so that people who because it's pretty exhausting for people to come to both, and we'd like people to have that option if they want it. So what I'm anticipating happening is that next week we'll have our first drop-in chat, and perhaps we can start going through Alan's recovery program. I think that by then we'll all have had a chance to read it and listen to all of the clips, and maybe we can start discussing it next, not this coming Tuesday, but the Tuesday afterward.
Oh, two
so
weeks.
Great. Interesting.
Yeah.
So this is going to be posted on the TMS forum?
Absolutely. Yep.
All right.
We will post it everywhere. That's my job. I've got to make
all
sure that people know about
it. Yeah. Alan Gordon. And
exactly. Well, and everybody, I think that was special about this. So he reviewed the structured educational program, and he felt like it's great in that it asks a lot of questions, but it doesn't necessarily give you the tools to handle the things which came up. And so another thing which may be on the horizon is integrating the two programs so that after you've done the recovery program, Alan Gordon's program, you can go and there will be specific references to it in the structured educational program. And I think that sounds like a good idea. So we will hopefully be able to work on that a little bit in the coming year.
So, Forrest, then you go through the SEP and you look for the links that lead you to Alan Gordon's program as a follow-up?
Yeah, so we had someone, so that the SEP is community written, and someone said that they wanted to work on the SEP and make it better. And what I said to him is, if you read through it and have some ideas and want to add them, then we can add a box. So some of you may know Shanshu Vampire from the TMS Wikis forum, and he wanted to go through and he's actually an MD, and he's worked with Alan. I don't think he's going to have time for this, but we discussed it, and I said, go ahead, we can add boxes to it. So the first idea for integrating the two programs would be just as Shanshu Vampire could go through and add kind of a Shanshu's corner or Shanshu's suggestion box to a number of the different pages in the SEP, in the Structured Educational Program that already exists on the wiki, we could go through and add little boxes for people who have already done Alan Gordon's recovery program that kind of refer back to it and draw connections between the two programs. And I want to say that for people who are excited about the recovery program or about the structured educational program, anybody who wants to go through the structured educational program and add boxes like that, that's something that I think we're open to and excited about supporting because we are a peer network and we really want to give people multiple perspectives, have discussions like we're having here today on this peer network and learn from each other. It's a place for scholarship in some sense.
What I was thinking of, monks with a palimpsest writing in the margins, marginalia.
A little marginalia. People can add their own marginalia. Because I really feel like us TMSers, we're really smart, at least the ones who show up on the forums. You know, we read a lot, we think deeply, and we get excited about what we're reading. So we often have really interesting things to say, and, I want us to learn from each other.
Yeah, I'm reading too many books all at once right now. I just started Gabor Mate's In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. Connecting addiction with TMS symptoms.
Okay, you know something really amazing about that? I almost mentioned that book to Howard Schubiner. He is doing some exciting stuff up in Michigan, and one of the things which they're working on is he's using some of the ideas from his program to do something. He's doing some sort of collaboration I can't announce this. This isn't a formal. I can't speak for him, I guess, is what I'm saying. But it sounds like he's having a significant collaboration with an addiction recovery clinic. So I thought that was very exciting and good to hear that he's drawing that connection too, and that some of the childhood issues that we have discovered in this book, in Pathways to Pain Relief, they can cause not only pain and other TMS symptoms, but also addiction. And the research, sorry for me to go on for a while, but the research supports this as well. Dr. Clark loves the study, says the most important medical study, I forget exactly how he phrases it, is this adverse childhood events study. We talked about it in an earlier podcast. Not only do these adverse childhood events increase the likelihood of getting TMS, but it also very significantly increases the risk of getting addictions. So it makes sense that Gabor Maté would have books not just about mind-body connection, but also about addiction, but also that Howard would be working with addictions as well.
Well, one important point that Dr. Maté makes in Hungry Ghosts is that behind almost every addict who uses crystal meth and heroin, there's a underlying, they call that, hyperactivity, attention deficit hyperactivity syndrome.
Uh-huh.
So it sounds to me as if I should be to go by a metaphorical leap, it's like the addict is plugging a certain drug into the biochemistry in his brain in order to complete the circuit, and TMS is operates similarly as a symptom substitute. It functions like a drug in that same model.
Giving the brain something that it needs.
Yeah, exactly. To fill in the blanks. I think that's the phrase I wanted to use. It fills in the blanks, the biochemical blanks. But the underlying condition is psychological behind both phenomena.
Bruce, are you saying that that you're talking about ADHD, and I feel like I've missed something there. Is it the actual ADHD itself, the hyperactivity that's filling in blanks in the brain?
No. Well.
Okay.
The person who is unable to focus on anything without adding chemical additives to his brain, there's a blank space there. And I'm saying that TMS symptoms function very much like drugs in filling in that blank space.
Okay. Well, that's interesting.
But anyway, I know this is kind of far afield.
Yeah. Well, for anyone who's interested,
not so far.
For anyone who's interested, Bruce has contributed some wonderful videos to our media library. Just go to tmswiki.org/forum, and near the top, I think there's a tab that says media, and you can see a bunch of videos, and a bunch of them over on the right, it says the name Gabor Maté, and you can watch some of those videos where he talks about his theories of mind-body interaction. He talks about his theories of drug addiction, and he talks about his theory of ADD. And all of them, I believe, have to do with childhood loss.
Yeah, well, Dr. Maté is saying that alcoholism, workaholism, consumerism, and drug addiction are all different aspects of they're all part of a continuous spectrum of symptoms that appear in our culture to do some of the same things because of underlying psychological problems that emerge in childhood.
Interesting. Fascinating stuff.
Yeah, I know it is. When you try and get a unified field theory of this stuff, it starts getting sort of far-fetched, but then you can see what points he's making, where Dr. Maté sees his own compulsive need to consume and buy all the time as being very much parallel with the need that the drug addict has to keep medicating himself. They aren't really so far apart. It's just we're more successful at what we do than the drug addict is.
Not
a self-destructive.
Or if you have a mind-body symptom, perhaps that's leaving you in pain, and there's this hole there, and the mind-body symptom distracts you from that pain, and kind of makes you whole again.
Yeah, he says that Dr. Mate says that the underlying condition behind all addicts is pain, an attempt to evade pain.
Interesting stuff. Okay, well, we should probably wrap it up. We've already gone over the chat room a little bit, but thank you, everyone, for joining us, and look forward to hearing from you next week.